Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith. Today I am joined by Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Bruce Hillman. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all 19 podcasts that we have there, including some new ones like Preaching the Text and Tough Texts.
Whoa.
A lot of textual podcasts there, just to make sure that you know that, you know, Thank You Fellows, we just did an episode on doctrine. Thank You Fellows exists because Christianity is a doctrinal religion, but our other shows exist because we read the Bible. So you can go to Tough Texts, Preaching the Text, 30 minutes in the New Testament, 40 minutes in the Old Testament. There's lots going on there. 19 shows in total. Go and check them out. If you're listening to Thinking Fellows, you'll probably enjoy some of the other content that we have there. Today we are still in Bruce's magical list, but Bruce, I found one. I found one that we've done before. We've done this countless times before. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a repeat, but it's a repeat. There's a reason we've done it multiple times, because it's a good repeat. And especially since, you know, not every listener is going to go listen to the entire backlog, so it's good to keep things fresh. And today's topic is, what theologians should you read? I actually thought this was a good follow-up from last week's episode, where we sort of asked the question, is Christianity a doctrinal religion, or why is it a doctrinal religion? And one of the results of that is that there are lots of theologians writing lots of books. You know, I was noticing, I was in a used bookstore up in the Pacific Northwest, and you go into the religion section, and Christianity, like, needs its own whole section. And then there's, like, other world religions, and it's half the size. So lots of Christian books out there.
You can tell that Caleb went into an actual bookstore for the first time in a long time.
We don't have them. We don't have them, like, anywhere. They don't exist in California anymore.
They don't have archives down there by...
It closed, Adam.
Really?
Archives closed, and I'll tell you, the used bookstores in California are all, like, meditative, like, you know, like, they're like granola spirituality. That's what bookstores are for. They're for crystals and buying, like, fancy paper.
Can I just say, in the tri-state area of the East Coast, the used bookstores are fantastic for good theological books. Probably because people are getting rid of them. But
Bruce is like, every time a old East Coast pastor dies, my library grows in size. You know,
true. It's 100% true. An angel gets his wings, and I get new books.
Yeah, an angel gets.
Oh my!
So, so besides Bruce's expanding, so Bruce, you have an expanding library, and so that's, we need to actually ask the question: what of the books in our libraries are actually worth reading? And
all of them.
All of them. And so, yeah, you gave us the question this week: what theologians should you read? So I'll just open it up. Whoever wants to go first can go. Thank you.
Read God and his word as mediated through the prophets and the apostles.
Very good answer.
That was a good show. Well, we'll see you guys next week. Let's
set
it off.
Buttons it up. Now, once you're finished reading God, where should you go?
Read God again.
Read God again. Where should you go?
I mean,
the nice thing about theology is, I mean, if someone's struggling with something or has a question about, you know, something deeper in their faith, Christianity is so well established as an academic discipline as well as a spiritual one that you really can find just about anybody, usually groups of people, you know, who can comment on stuff. And I think, just as a general, like, disclaimer, pretty much any theologian you read, you have to read skeptically, or critically maybe is a better word than skeptically, because you're not going to agree with everything they say, and that's okay. And some you'll agree with way more than with others. But I think even the ones we disagree with, they can strengthen your own faith if you're mature enough to read them, if you have a greater context, because you can say, oh, I don't agree with that. And even in that context, they sometimes can make good points on certain things. So I think, just as we're, you know, what theologians should we read? there's all kinds. It depends on what your should is for.
Yeah. I think context plays a huge role in this because, I mean, some things are worth your time if you're, you know, if you're studying theology for a profession, if you're going to be a pastor, maybe this list is different. If you're going to be a pastor in certain contexts, the list could be different, right? Like if you're going to be a pastor to university faculty, the list might be different than if you're a pastor in rural, small town, Big Bear Lake, you know, right? Like it's the questions you'll get from parishioners or the pastoral care would be different. If you're doing theology academically, that list might be broader, but then narrow down based on expertise or subject matter. So, and then for, you know, the lay listener, I think you could add, like you said, if you're critical, the list could include almost anything that your interest, it piques your interest, but it should also, I guess I see your question as saying, it should also include these essentials, perhaps if you're taking the time to do some theological reading on the side.
I always think when we do these shows, it's really important to just give, because I think people are like tuning in and they're like, all right, Thinking Fellows are finally going to tell me what I need to do here. Going to stop being so, you know, like in their head,
mushy,
and they're just going to say, if you do this, you'll learn something, right? And so,
are you going to tell them that's not true?
No, I'm going to say, you know, let's just give them some solid and classic recommendations here. Like, I don't know. We're all Lutheran, so we might start a little bit after reading God, as Adam said. We might start with saying, hey, you should check out Martin Luther. And then from there, you could kind of get more specific and say, I'd say we've said this a lot, mostly in the past, though. Small Catechism.
Mm-hmm.
Check that out. The highly underrated Large Catechism. Check that out, too.
Also not super large for those who haven't read it before.
Yeah, the name is a little deceptive.
It's the larger.
Yeah, larger catechism. Yeah. Check those things out.
The Christian is a really good little essay if people are.
Yeah. Yep.
And we have a translation of that as well, courtesy of Adam, actually.
Yeah, I tried. I forgot about that.
Adam has a translation of Freedom of the Christian that is available through 1517, so I will put a link in the show notes there.
Well, I think we've recommended at some point checking out all the three treatises, right?
Yeah.
The Address to the Christian Nobility, Freedom of the Christian, and the Babylonian Captivity of the Church. Those are good. You can usually get those in one little volume, mm-hmm. right? Sort of Luther's introductory sort of works there. Small Catechism still pretty early. Large Catechism still pretty early for Luther. Check those out. It's kind of nice. So I'd start there. Hey, Lutherans. I said Lutheran.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. We can always go back to our favorite too, underrated, Philip Melanchthon, albeit not as much in English to read.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really think if you are interested in Reformation theology, in fact, if you are a Protestant at all, Luther or not, you should find a copy of the 1521 Loci and read it. It is foundational for all Protestants.
Yeah.
There might be adjustments later, but this is an essential work which helps differentiate the starting point from medieval Roman Catholicism.
That's why I made it into the Library of Christian Classics, which is one of the places where you can find the 1521 translation.
And today, too, I think there are some challenging things for people in Melanchthon that you wouldn't even notice. So classical theism is making a comeback. Scholastic Protestantism is making a comeback. Melanchthon, slowly over time, perhaps introduces a little more scholastic method into the Loci. But that 1521 blows apart some of the assumptions about what it means to outline theology apart from a scholastic system. You have things like the doctrine of God is not a single locus that's at the beginning of your systematics with a list of attributes. The Trinity, similarly, is sort of dissected into different ways. And so you can see an approach to doing organized Christian theology that confesses the doctrine of God, that confesses the Trinity, confesses some of these other things, but does not strictly organize them in a way that classical Christianity and Protestant / general scholasticism demands must be done in order to begin your theological project. And so I think it's a really good return for people who, because lots of people are trying to take up theology in a serious manner again, especially in the United States, as we react to, as we talked about in the last episode, more and more Christian doctrine becoming sort of subjective and giving way to experiences.
Cool.
Bruce, you got some recommendations? I know you're going to say Augustine.
I have lots of recommendations. obviously, for me, you're going to hear that Christians should read Augustine, and I recommend they read the Confessions as their first foray into him. And just read the first 10 books, just equivalent to sort of chapters in the way that he wrote that. And you can skip the last three because there are commentary on Genesis in the book and they don't necessarily connect easily with what came before. And that's a very easily accessible book for a lot of people who want to think, and just is a fascinating book. So Augustine's Confessions for me is really important. For more like modern theologians, when it comes to like racial recognition and racial reconciliation and that kind of stuff that's really important to people nowadays, I like Miroslav Volf. His books and articles, you can find his stuff. He teaches at Yale. He's an evangelical, though. I think he's one of the only evangelicals who still is on the faculty as an evangelical at Yale. He studied under Jürgen Moltmann. And he grew up in the Serbian conflict. And in one of the books he writes in the introduction, he says, so they had this derogatory term for the enemy during the war, and they were called a Senec. And it basically meant someone who murdered and raped your family. And years later, you know, he's a theologian and he's asked, you know, you're a Christian theologian, can you love a Senec? And he had to stop and think about it. And he said, it's kind of what occasioned this book. He said, no, I actually can't, but I think Jesus would want me to. And the book is a very intelligent scriptural way to deal with, I guess, what you would call the race issue. And it recognizes, for example, that, you know, if races just compete to sort of say, I'm the bigger victim, it'll just lead to more problems. So he's very much nervous about races that have experienced injustice simply being claiming victim status as a way to do it, but still recognizing that, you know, people who are victims of injustice still have a process they need to go through, and God cares about that. So Miroslav Volf is really good, and he's very solid, so I'd recommend him.
I feel like the Augustine was a very classic recommendation, and then
you really jumped.
I was like, we really jumped. We went hundreds of years
into the future.
And then two more, I would say. Philip Carey, I really like. I've appreciated him for years. He teaches at Eastern. He's written a bunch of books. He is a Episcopal / Anglican. He's American. But his area of specialty is Augustine and Luther. So he interacts with a lot of those two. And he has a fantastic book that came out not long ago, which I highly recommend, which is Meaning of Protestant Theology. And that's it shows where Protestant theology left it in some, well, not left, but where it took a very specific form of Augustinian theology, and then Luther sort of ran with that and disagreed with parts of it. So he has a little article called Why Luther is Not Quite Protestant, because Luther isn't really like the Baptists and the Methodists and the other, and he's not Catholic. So he sits in this sort of middle spot. So Carey's really good. He also has another book called Good News for Anxious Christians, which is completely written for lay people, which is that I think it's the 10 things you don't have to do. And it's really a critique about modern Christianity and how it, wants you to find Jesus in your heart all the time and wants you to, keep doing all these things in order to have a good piety. And he critiques that. He's also a very good communicator. He has a lot of free resources on his
Did Kelsey interview him?
Academy.com.
Did she interview him? I know she used sort of the Good News for Anxious Christians was like the jumping off point for her master's thesis.
I've actually met him a few times. He's been very generous and very nice. We had lunch one time. He's a great guy. He's what you see is what you get. And then the last one is the most controversial.
Yeah, she did. We have a video with Kelsey did a podcast with him.
We should link that maybe.
Yeah, I'll put a link in there. But Kelsey did do a podcast recently with Carrie back in April. So
yeah, he's a great communicator. And a lot, like I said, if you're curious about like predestination and topics that are, I will call them controversial, Carrie has a lot of free articles that are like 3-4 pages long that are made for students that he offers for free. And they're fantastic summaries of the debate. So he doesn't really take a position in those papers, but he just outlines very simply what the debate is. Check those out. Cool. As well.
Adam.
And then the last one I would recommend, which I said, like I said, you will all hate, is Karl Barth. I know. But I will recommend not that you read the Dogmatics or anything crazy like that. There is a 4-part series that just finished called Barth in Conversation. And this is actually translated for the first time into English. And it is conversations he had with other Christian denominations. And what I like about it is, first of all, it's just him talking, so it's very accessible. And two, you can see where the disagreements with Barth are very clearly with your whatever group you're coming from. And I just think you can't do modern theology or understand any modern theology without having an understanding of Barth. That's why I recommend him.
So my other show I record with Steve Paulson all the time, right?
He hates Barth, doesn't he?
Oh, and there's a couple names where, like, you'll just mention them, and you know me, Bruce, as you said, it's not like I'm sitting here, like, being like, oh, Barth, But you just, like, even say the name, and I could just, like see the face. I could see the face on the Zoom,
Well, I was here thinking, I really hope Rod never listens to this episode. Not that I think he does regularly, let me make clear that Rod did assign Barth in his 20th century theology class. Now, he did it with a very...
a grimace.
Like, you're going to hate this. If you don't hate this, you should question yourself.
I disagree with Barth on most everything he says, but I do find he's very important for two reasons. One is he does recover modern theology from its crazy German roots by bringing it back about Christ. And he changes the trajectory of modern theology. And all modern theology that follows in many ways has to either agree or disagree with him. That is, they have to take up his conclusions and deal with it, because he does change the course of all of Western theology's trajectory by making it, once again, Christocentric, maybe too Christocentric. That's one of the areas I actually disagree with him. He's not very Trinitarian, and I think that creates a problem. The second thing is I do think his view on predestination, which is the one area where I actually find him compelling and I'm sympathetic to him, is a very biblically sound version predestination. It can lend itself towards universalism, although Barth denied that was what he was trying to do, so there are problems with it. But if you want to have a view of predestination that you can still hold the Lutheran view, for example, but you also just need something else to sort of supplement that, because Luther leaves a lot of room for mystery, Barth won't solve that mystery, but he'll sort of change the way that the view of predestination from being very individualistic to being much more Christocentric and making it very good news again. That's one of the areas I like about him. But as far as his view of the Word of God, just if you're a listener and you don't know much about him, he has a very, I would say, bad view of the...
Yeah, I would say bad.
Yeah. Word of God. Because he thinks that the Word of God only becomes God's Word when it's preached, and in God's sovereignty, God decides that in that preaching it will, in that proclamation, it will become divinely inspired or whatever. He wouldn't even use that word, but that it would become God's word. So
meaningful.
Shifting character. Yeah.
It becomes meaningful.
He uses a lot of Christian vocabulary, but doesn't always mean the same thing as we're used to by it. So that's why I recommend, if you are interested in him, read the In Conversation books, where you're reading him alongside his critics, and then you can kind of see where the real debates are.
Well, Adam, I'm sure we can get a different recommendation from you.
Adam's going to go right to Moltmann.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Oh, no.
Rudolf Bultmann, maybe even.
May give you. I don't read much theology anymore. I read more like the prolegomena to it, the apologetic stuff. But let me take a stab at it. I'm going to say Robert Kolb's "The Genius of Luther's Theology" is outstanding.
Yeah,
I think you could add Kolb as like a theologian who, depending on where you want to read, there's very rarely a miss there.
Yep.
I think Substantially is a great book. I find that book very boringly written, though. I think he has better books.
Well, I mean, you're kind of a boring guy, so...
What is that?
Maybe think? It's... I think I've recommended him before, and this is more apologetics than it is theology, but Jim Sayers' books.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. The Why Should Anyone Believe Anything at All?
That's a great book. A
great little... And it's a fun read, Bruce.
Not boring.
Not boring. There are Lewis Marcus. We've talked about him before.
Yeah.
He's got Apologetics for the 21st Century, but he's also got, Scott, you're the one who turned me on to this, or prompted me to go and order it some time ago. Books like, the exact titles, I'm not totally sure. It's like From Achilles to Christ.
Yeah.
And it's like Plato to Christ.
It's doing sort of what the Planet Narnia guy says Lewis was doing. Michael Ward says Lewis was doing, like the connection between sort of the trying to draw in a line between sort of ancient myth and Christ.
Yep. Yeah.
He has a book on C.S. Lewis or something too, doesn't he?
Yes.
Several.
I read it last year. I'm trying to find the title.
I'm going to also say, and I don't think Rod would be too disappointed here, but I think Alistair McGrath's books on scientific theology and that sort of orbit. I mean, his stuff on Reformation is great, but is really good. David Anderson, who has a new book coming out through 1517, the new academic imprint, has a book called What Can We Really Know, which is a book on epistemology and so on. But he draws... quite a bit from Alistair McGrath. He was a student of McGrath. That's good stuff.
The Lewis Marcus, where he does sort of, I'd say it's for educators. So this book is very much written for somebody who would be teaching a class on this, because he even has like questions for the class at the end of every chapter. But it's very much sort of the Lewis connecting classical myth and sort of the myth made fact. It's just called The Myth Made Fact by Lewis Marcus. It's very good. I'd say if you were prepping for a class on such a topic, it'd be my go-to.
Yeah, or if you're just somebody who's interested in the classics, you live in that world. My kids grew up reading the Greek and Roman and some of the Norse classics, and so that world, that sort of approach brings things to life for them.
I think taught years ago a course on Lewis at the teaching company, the Great Courses, which was audio only, but I think it's like free or affordable.
Marcus, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. It's called,
it's short and well done. Like,
I think it's just called like Honor. Lewis. Yeah, I'll find it.
He's a good presenter on top of being like a good writer. Like, he's entertaining to listen to.
The
Life and Writings of C.S. Lewis. It is a great course.
Yeah. But we, C.S. Lewis, anything by C.S. Lewis is a great read.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say we had that episode on orthodoxy as a term a while ago. I'm going to say G.K. Chesterton's orthodoxy is really good. Chesterton's not the easiest to read.
I was going to say it's a slog.
It is a bit of a workout, but it's good. Well, compared to like the Everlasting Man, I found it very refreshing.
I actually liked Everlasting Man better.
Interesting. Oh, I think I'm with Adam on this. I didn't actually end up finishing Everlasting Man because, yeah.
It was Everlasting.
Yeah.
No, I had to start and stop it several times. Yeah. You know, if I could just, in Bruce's fashion, just keep naming books.
Yeah, well, I was going to interrupt you, but go for it.
You guys should see Adam on the screen. He's putting his flex on. He's like, he looks like we're getting Hulk Hogan in a wrestling.
I have like a pairing, like cheese and wine pairing to go for, which is, again, I'm just going to default to, we're Lutheran. Not every listener is Lutheran. If you're trying to get a perspective on Lutheranism, and that's why you're non-Lutheran listening to Thinking Fellows, or if you're a Lutheran sort of listening to understand Lutheran, answer the question, what is Lutheranism, for yourself in practice. The thing that got me, maybe to your chagrin here, interested in doing theology versus some of the other disciplines that I was done, is that in high school, I was assigned this cheese and wine pairing of from my dad here, of Bob Kolb and Steve Paulson at the same time, reading these books in conjunction. And I actually think, as pairs from different denominational backgrounds, but who are both engaged in, you know, contemporary Luther scholarship, is both sort of their alley. You can read something like The Genius of Luther's Theology and Luther for Armchair Theologians together.
That's fantastic. I like that.
You can read something like Bound Choice and Wittenberg Theological Method and Outlaw God, Volume 1, in pairing.
Believe it or not, Bound Choice is going to be easier to get through.
Yeah.
Do you think then The Genius of Luther's Theology?
No.
Oh.
No, I'm saying they have other books, right? There's
Bound Choice is great.
It is a really good. It's a really good examination of the Wittenberg
theological method,
yeah. And the relationship, honestly, between Luther and Melanchthon really shines bright, yeah, in that.
It's a very, very good book.
But I think reading them in conjunction is a very helpful exercise. And so, like, if I were to say, you want to understand, or you want to picture into the thought of Martin Luther, and then how that impacts the question, what is Lutheranism in view of the confessions, I think reading Kolb and Paulson's various books sort of intermixed with each other is a really good way to do that.
Because you get two people that are really trying to do accomplish a very similar goal, like each other very much and agree with each other very much, coming at it from different perspectives, should I say, or I don't even know if perspectives is right, sort of, you can just see that their theological training was just that slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Are they different storytellers? Like one's making a Western, another one's making a drama, but they're telling the same story.
I like that.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Bruce.
Yeah. They tell the story in a different way, even though they're trying to tell the same story.
And I think of the people I can think of who have done contemporary Luther, it's good and reliable and uses a really good mixture of the Bible and Luther's commentary on the Bible as well.
I think it's fair to say that within sort of 20th and 21st century American Lutheranism, they're two of the names that will be still read in 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, and 100 years, whatever. I mean, they're the two names. You could throw Ferdy in there too, I'm sure, and I'm sure I'm missing some LCMS theologians.
Throw Weingart in there, although I don't agree with Weingart.
It's just that they made an impact in the field, in a way that, you know, is so broad reaching that it'll be remembered.
And both can be read by the average person.
Sure.
So.
Especially, I think sometimes Paulson's a little bit harder. Like, I think Outlaw God's a little bit more difficult, but Lutheran theology isn't. Luther for Armchair Theologians isn't his one that nobody's even...
Well, used. A podcast exists.
A brief introduction to Martin Luther is very good.
A podcast exists to help you through Outlaw God.
The
Outlaw God podcast.
It is a great podcast. I think it's a little telling that the book needs a podcast to explain the book, but that's fine.
The podcast doesn't explain. It's in dialogue with the book.
All right, sorry.
I want to throw one more out there.
Get the flex on.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, are you going to surprise us with this one or not surprise us?
No, it's a real basic book. But again, because I'm, for me, the truthfulness of all this stuff is what I'm like, is sort of like my little world. Paul Meyer's book used to be called In the Fullness of Time. Now is, has a new title. It's been updated a bit, called The Genuine Jesus. We'll take you through the life of Jesus, through the travels of Paul, and point out all along all the archaeological and historiographical details that we have that confirm or correspond to the...
I think I like the title In the Fullness of Time better.
Yeah,
I do too. But whatever it is, I mean, that's it is what it is. It's a, and not only is it a good book in terms of content, but extremely easy to read. It's classic Paul Meyer. He's a great storyteller, and great footnotes and so on and so forth. So.
That's good.
I'm a simpleton though, so I don't, you know, outlaw God would be way above my head in these days.
I don't think so. I think you'd enjoy it, actually, because he engages with a lot of, European philosophy thought, ancient philosophy and thought as well. So there's, it's sort of more than just doing doctrine over again. So there's a lot of sort of tracing the history of ideas in Outlaw God that I think is enjoyable.
I like that.
You probably would like it. I've got one. I'm going to throw out Gene V. Scott at Work. But I'm going to, in a wine and cheese pairing, I'm going to do it with Michael Berg's book that we just published on vocation too. Because I think an understanding of Christian vocation has the potential to really set a lot of people free. And in a way that sort of our normal theologians of glory understanding of what God or belief of what God quote unquote wants from us in everyday life, and our misunderstandings therein, you know, it's really a good understanding of Christian vocation can really set people free. So
what attracts you guys to, like, when you discover a new theologian, is it usually through a recommendation of a friend or because of like a footnote or you heard about them? Like, what do you have a way that tends
it's
to?
It's almost exclusively for me been recommendations. I mean, the journey, as I said, started in high school with obviously you'd call them recommendations, but assignments from, you know, the person sitting to my right. And then after college, obviously in college things are assigned, but then the best reading is the ones that go beyond that. So recommendations from professors and friends. But yeah, recommendations from friends. I have a group of like 3 or 4 friends who recommend more books than I can keep up with, I would say.
I think when I'm actively researching, it's probably footnotes. But in times when I'm not actively researching, it's just hearing what other people are reading and kind of saying, all right.
I've been trying to, you know, like I go through waves. Like Adam said, I take pauses where I'll be reading less explicitly sort of theological works and maybe more history of ideas, history of the West stuff.
Just history. That's me. I just get sucked in.
So I do that and then I'll go back and, you know, some of the most recent recommendations to me have been Zasa and Ellert, Werner Ellert. And I've read both of them recently and both great, but like, and maybe it's a style thing, but like Ellert's structure of Lutheranism just stood out to me. Like I just could keep reading it page after page. That doesn't always happen when I open a theological book anymore. It did certainly in the years ago, but I don't always like get sucked in. And for such a big systematic book too, I wouldn't have thought so. But there was something about sort of the plain outline sort of historical structure in the structure of Lutheranism. Like every 3 sentences is a Luther quote or a quote from the Confessions or a quote from Scripture or from somewhere else in Lutheranism. Like every three, it's amazing. And there's so much reference to those works that I just felt like I could just keep getting pulled along by it. So really enjoyed that too and stuff. So I think, yeah, recommendation is usually how I find stuff.
Well, on that note, you could add on the vocation list, Werner Hellert's Lutheran Vocation.
Mm-hmm.
I also go off recommendations, but my predominant way actually, and I recommend this to readers if they're interested, is I will go to many seminaries' websites that I know from famous seminaries to maybe not so famous seminaries. And I will, a lot of times on those websites, you can gain access.
I'm sorry, I meant Wingren. I messed that up.
Wingren.
Sorry.
I can edit.
Gustav Wingren, sorry. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you can find on the websites usually the book reading list for each of the classes. And so what you can do is you can go onto the book, you know, school bookstore or whatever, or their Amazon list.
Mm.
You can see, like, what are the professors assigning to students this year? Now, just be careful because you don't know if they're assigned the book because they like it or hate it, because you don't have enough context to know. But at least if you start seeing patterns, and so, you know, you go to a class that you're interested in, you find equivalent classes in that area in other seminaries, and you start seeing the same newer books appearing, you go, okay, this is an important book. Multiple professors are talking about this book. Maybe I need to research this and see if this is the book I want to read. So that's generally how I try to keep myself fresh with what's going on. And then determining if I, you know, actually want to read the book or not.
Yeah.
It's an easy way to do it. And if you like this, like the treasure hunt, so to speak, of what's out there, which I do, can be a fun exercise.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, because like, yeah, I was going to say the way you get, in our case, so much of the reading list was by being in school at some point, right?
And when you get out of school, you're like, I don't know what's, people are talking about anymore.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know. Do we cover?
Maybe we did a good job.
We cover our bases here. I mean, again,
each other on our backs.
Yeah. I would, you know, there's always this caveat that some of the books we recommended are not for everybody. I mean, I think we recommended some 800 page books in here. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But I'm going to do my best in. Editing here to compile the list of things that were recommended and put it in the show notes. We used to do this on these episodes, have show notes that were a million links long. So I'm going to do my best to do that. And I'm if I miss any, people will email me. I guarantee it. But I'm going to try to put it in order as well. So.
I did mention it by name, so I should if you're going to do that. Miroslav Volf's book is called Exclusion and Embrace, but you can read articles by him too. But fantastic book. It won a ton of awards. It's a little older now. It's probably 15, 20 years old, but still very relevant.
Yeah, that's great. Well, awesome, guys. Glad to do this again. Probably revisit the subject in a year, year and a half again as well, because I think this, it's slightly different every time. So it's a good episode to revisit. If you enjoyed this episode, if you found some of our recommendations interesting or helpful, if you're going to check out some of the links in the show notes, please also stop by that very first link in the show notes that says support this show. The Thing Fellows is, and all of the podcasts on the 1517 Podcast Network are free to listen to, but they're also, you know, if you're a longtime listener, you've probably noticed this, ad-free. And that's something I like to keep the show for the shows. We have uninterrupted dialogue and conversation on these shows. And if you enjoy that, if that's a part of the shows that makes them enjoyable for you, please consider supporting us financially. You can go to 1517.org/donate-podcasts, or again, follow that top link in the show notes that says support this show. And yeah, and that helps us keep the shows as is. We will catch you next time. Bye.